Chapter 2. The Meaning of Numbers. 1. It is necessary to begin by drawing attention to certain basic terms which, as used in this work, carry strict and in some cases novel connotations. Though the metaphysical content of these terms would gradually become evident in following the course of the reasoning, nevertheless, the exact significance to be attached to them ought to be made clear beyond misunderstanding from the very outset. The popular distinction, current also in philosophy, between being and becoming seems to miss the essential point in the contrast it is meant to express. An endless becoming, action, actuality, will always be thought of also as a condition, as it is, for example, in physical notions such as uniform velocity and the condition of motion, and in the basic hypothesis of the kinetic theory of gases, and therefore ranked in the category of being. On the other hand, out of the results that we do in fact obtain by and in consciousness, we may, with Goethe, distinguish as final elements becoming and the become. Das Werden, das Gefordene. In all cases, though the atom of humanness may lie beyond the grasp of our powers of abstract conception, the very clear and definite feeling of this contrast, fundamental and diffused throughout consciousness, is the most elemental something that we reach. It necessarily follows, therefore, that the become is always founded on a becoming and not the other way round. I distinguish further, by the words proper and alien, das eigene, das fremde, those two basic facts of consciousness which for all men in the waking, not in the dreaming state, are established with an immediate inward certainty, without the necessity or possibility of more precise definition. The element called alien is always related in some way to the basic fact expressed by the word perception, i.e., the outer world, the life of sensation. Great thinkers have bent all their powers of image-forming to the task of expressing this relation more and more rigorously by the aid of half-intuitive dichotomies such as phenomena and things in themselves, world as will and world as idea, ego and non-ego. Although human powers of exact knowing are surely inadequate for the task. Similarly, the element proper is involved with the basic fact known as feeling, i.e., the inner life, in some intimate and invariable way that equally defies analysis by the methods of abstract thought. I distinguish again soul and world. The existence of this opposition is identical with the fact of purely human waking consciousness. Wachsein. There are degrees of clearness and sharpness in the opposition, and therefore grades of the consciousness, of the spirituality, of life. These grades range from the feeling knowledge that, unalert, yet sometimes suffused through and through by an inward light, is characteristic of the primitive and of the child, and also of those moments of religious and artistic inspiration that occur ever less and less often as a culture grows older, right to the extremity of waking and reasoning sharpness that we find, for instance, in the thought of Kant and Napoleon, for whom soul and world have become subject and object. This elementary structure of consciousness, as a fact of immediate inner knowledge, is not susceptible of conceptual subdivision. Nor indeed are the two factors distinguishable at all except verbally and more or less artificially, since they are always associated, always intertwined, and present themselves as a unit, a totality. The epistemological starting point of the born idealist and the born realist alike, the assumption that soul is to world, or world to soul, as the case may be, as foundation is to building, as primary to derivative, as cause to effect, has no basis whatever in the pure fact of consciousness. And when a philosophic system lays stress on the one or the other, it only thereby informs us as to the personality of the philosopher, a fact of purely biographical significance. Thus, by regarding waking consciousness structurally as a tension of contraries, and applying it to the notions of becoming and the thing become, we find for the word life a perfectly definite meaning that is closely allied to that of becoming. We may describe becomings and the things become as the form in which respectively the facts and the results of life exist in the waking consciousness. To man in the waking state, his proper life, progressive and constantly self-fulfilling, is presented through the element of becoming in his consciousness. This fact we call the present, and it possesses that mysterious property of direction which in all the higher languages men have sought to impound, and vainly, to rationalize by means of the enigmatic word time. It follows necessarily from the above that there is a fundamental connection between the become, the hard set, and death. If now we designate the soul, that is the soul as it is felt, not as it is reasonably pictured, as the possible, and the world on the other hand as the actual, the meaning of these expressions is unmistakable to man's inner sense. We see life as the form in which the actualizing of the possible is accomplished. With respect to the property of direction, the possible is called the future, and the actualized, the past. The actualizing itself, the center of gravity and the center of meaning of life, we call the present. Soul is the still to be accomplished, world the accomplished, life the accomplishing. In this way, we are enabled to assign to expressions like moment, duration, development, life content, vocation, scope, aim, fullness and emptiness of life, the definite meanings which we shall need for all that follows, and especially for the understanding of historical phenomena. Lastly, the words history and nature are here employed, as the reader will have observed already, in a quite definite and hitherto unusual sense. These words comprise possible modes of understanding, of comprehending the totality of knowledge, becoming as well as things become, life as well as things lived, as a homogeneous, spiritualized, well-ordered world picture fashioned out of an indivisible mass impression in this way or in that, according as the becoming or the become, direction, time, or extension, space, is the dominant factor. And it is not a question of one factor being alternative to the other. The possibilities that we have of possessing an outer world that reflects and attests our proper existence are infinitely numerous and exceedingly heterogeneous, and the purely organic and the purely mechanical worldview, in the precise literal sense of that familiar term, are only the extreme members of the series. Primitive man, so far as we can imagine his waking consciousness, and the child, as we can remember, cannot fully see or grasp these possibilities. One condition of this higher world consciousness is the possession of language, meaning thereby not mere human utterance, but a culture language, and such is non-existent for primitive man, and existent but not accessible in the case of the child. In other words, neither possesses any clear and distinct notion of the world. They have an inkling, but no real knowledge of history and nature, being too intimately incorporated with the ensemble of these. They have no culture. And therewith, that important word is given a positive meaning of the highest significance, which henceforward will be assumed in using it. In the same way as we have elected to distinguish the soul as the possible and the world as the actual, we can now differentiate between possible and actual culture, i.e., culture as an idea in the general or individual existence, and culture as the body of that idea, as the total of its visible, tangible and comprehensible expressions, acts and opinions, religion and state, arts and sciences, peoples and cities, economic and social forms, speech, laws, customs, characters, facial lines and costumes. Higher history, intimately related to life and to becoming, is the actualizing of possible culture. Footnote. The case of mankind in the historyless state is discussed in Volume 2. End of footnote. We must not omit to add that these basic determinations of meaning are largely incommunicable by specification, definition, or proof, and in their deeper import must be reached by feeling, experience, and intuition. There is a distinction, rarely appreciated as it should be, between experience as lived and experience as learnt, zwischen erleben und erkennen, between the immediate certainty given by the various kinds of intuition, such as illumination, inspiration, artistic flair, experience of life, the power of sizing men up, Goethe's exact percipient fancy, and the product of rational procedure and technical experiment. The first are imparted by means of analogy, picture, symbol, the second by formula, law, scheme. The become is experienced by learning. Indeed, as we shall see, the having become is for the human mind identical with the completed act of cognition. A becoming, on the other hand, can only be experienced by living, felt with a deep, wordless understanding. It is on this that what we call knowledge of men is based. In fact, the understanding of history implies a superlative knowledge of men. The eye which can see into the depths of an alien soul owes nothing to the cognition methods investigated in the Critique of Pure Reason. Yet the purer the historical picture is, the less accessible it becomes to any other eye. The mechanism of a pure nature picture, such as the world of Newton and Kant, is cognized, grasped, dissected in laws and equations, and finally reduced to system. The organism of a pure history picture, like the world of Plotinus, Dante, and Giordano Bruno, is intuitively seen, inwardly experienced, grasped as a form or symbol, and finally rendered in poetical and artistic conceptions. Goethe's living nature is a historical world picture, with, moreover, a biological horizon. 2. In order to exemplify the way in which a soul seeks to actualize itself in the picture of its outer world, to show, that is, in how far culture in the become state can express or portray an idea of human existence, I have chosen number, the primary element on which all mathematics rests. I have done so because mathematics, accessible in its full depth only to the very few, holds a quite peculiar position amongst the creations of the mind. It is a science of the most rigorous kind, like logic, but more comprehensive and very much fuller. It is a true art, along with sculpture and music, as needing the guidance of inspiration and as developing under great conventions of form. It is, lastly, a metaphysic of the highest rank, as Plato and above all Leibniz show us. Every philosophy has hitherto grown up in conjunction with a mathematic belonging to it. Number is the symbol of causal necessity. Like the conception of God, it contains the ultimate meaning of the world as nature. The existence of numbers may therefore be called a mystery, and the religious thought of every culture has felt their impress. Just as all becoming possesses the original property of direction, irreversibility, all things become possess the property of extension. But these two words seem unsatisfactory in that only an artificial distinction can be made between them. the real secret of all things become, which are ipso facto things extended, spatially and materially, is embodied in mathematical number, as contrasted with chronological number. Mathematical number contains, in its very essence, the notion of a mechanical demarcation, number being in that respect akin to word, which in the very fact of its comprising and denoting fences off world impressions. The deepest depths, it is true, are here both incomprehensible and inexpressible. But the actual number with which the mathematician works, the figure, formula, sign, diagram, in short, the number sign which he thinks, speaks, or writes exactly, is, like the exactly used word, from the first a symbol of these depths, something imaginable, communicable, comprehensible to the inner and the outer eye, which can be accepted as representing the demarcation. The origin of numbers resembles that of the myth. Primitive man elevates indefinable nature impressions, the alien in our terminology, into deities, noumena, at the same time capturing and impounding them by a name which limits them. So also numbers are something that marks off and captures nature impressions. And it is by means of names and numbers that the human understanding obtains power over the world. In the last analysis, the number language of a mathematic and the grammar of a tongue are structurally alike. Logic is always a kind of mathematic, and vice versa. Consequently, in all acts of the intellect germane to mathematical number, measuring, counting, drawing, weighing, arranging and dividing, also thinking in money, men strive to delimit the extended in words as well, i.e. to set forth in the form of proofs, conclusions, theorems and systems. And it is only through acts of this kind, which may be more or less unintentioned, that waking man begins to be able to use numbers, normatively, to specify objects and properties, relations and differentiae, unities and pluralities. Briefly, that structure of the world picture which he feels as necessary and unshakable, calls nature and cognizes. Nature is the numerable, while history, on the other hand, is the aggregate of that which has no relation to mathematics. Hence the mathematical certainty of the laws of nature, the astounding rightness of Galileo's saying that nature is written in mathematical language, and the fact, emphasized by Kant, that exact natural science reaches just as far as the possibilities of applied mathematics allow it to reach. In number, then, as the sign of completed demarcation, lies the essence of everything actual, which is cognized, is delimited, and has become all at once, as Pythagoras and certain others have been able to see with complete inward certitude by a mighty and truly religious intuition. Nevertheless, mathematics, meaning thereby the capacity to think practically in figures, must not be confused with the far narrower scientific mathematics, that is, the theory of numbers as developed in lecture and treatise. The mathematical vision and thought that a culture possesses within itself is as inadequately represented by its written mathematic as its philosophical vision and thought by its philosophical treatises. Number springs from a source that has also quite other outlets. Thus, at the beginning of every culture we find an archaic style, which might fairly have been called geometrical in other cases as well as the early Hellenic. There is a common factor which is expressly mathematical in this early classical style of the 10th century BC, in the temple style of the Egyptian 4th dynasty with its absolutism of straight line and right angle, in the early Christian sarcophagus relief, and in Romanesque construction and ornament. Here, every line, every deliberately non-imitative figure of man and beast, reveals a mystic number thought in direct connection with the mystery of death, the hard set. Gothic cathedrals and Doric temples are mathematics in stone. Doubtless Pythagoras was the first in the classical culture to conceive number scientifically as the principle of a world order of comprehensible things, as standard and as magnitude. But even before him it had found expression as a noble arraying of sensuous material units in the strict canon of the statue and the Doric order of columns. The great arts are, one and all, modes of interpretation by means of limits based on number. Consider, for example, the problem of space representation in oil painting. A high mathematical endowment may, without any mathematical science whatsoever, come to fruition and full self-knowledge in technical spheres. In the presence of so powerful a number sense as that evidenced, even in the Old Kingdom, in the dimensioning of pyramid temples and in the technique of building, water control and public administration, not to mention the calendar, no one surely would maintain that the valueless arithmetic of Ahmes belonging to the new empire represents the level of Egyptian mathematics. The Australian natives, who rank intellectually as thorough primitives, possess a mathematical instinct, or what comes to the same thing, a power of thinking in numbers which is not yet communicable by signs or words, that, as regards the interpretation of pure space, is far superior to that of the Greeks. Their discovery of the boomerang can only be attributed to their having a sure feeling for numbers of a class that we should refer to the higher geometry. Accordingly, we shall justify the adverb later, they possess an extraordinarily complicated ceremonial and, for expressing degrees of affinity, such fine shades of language as not even the higher cultures themselves can show. There is analogy, again, between the Euclidean mathematic and the absence, in the Greek of the mature Periclean age, of any feeling either for ceremonial public life or for loneliness, while the Baroque, differing sharply from the classical, presents us with a mathematic of spatial analysis, a court of Versailles and a state system resting on dynastic relations. It is the style of a soul that comes out in the world of numbers, and the world of numbers includes something more than the science thereof. 3. From this there follows a fact of decisive importance which has hitherto been hidden from the mathematicians themselves. There is not, and cannot be, number as such. There are several number worlds, as there are several cultures. We find an Indian, an Arabian, a classical, a Western type of mathematical thought, and, corresponding with each, a type of number. Each type fundamentally peculiar and unique, an expression of a specific world feeling, a symbol having a specific validity which is even capable of scientific definition, a principle of ordering the become which reflects the central essence of one and only one soul, viz., the soul of that particular culture. Consequently, there are more mathematics than one. For indubitably the inner structure of the Euclidean geometry is something quite different from that of the Cartesian. The analysis of Archimedes is something other than the analysis of Gauss. And not merely in matters of form, intuition and method, but above all in essence, in the intrinsic and obligatory meaning of number which they respectively develop and set forth. This number, the horizon within which it has been able to make phenomena self-explanatory, and therefore the whole of the nature, or world extended, that is confined in the given limits and amenable to its particular sort of mathematic, are not common to all mankind, but specific in each case to one definite sort of mankind. The style of any mathematic which comes into being, then, depends wholly on the culture in which it is rooted, the sort of mankind it is that ponders it. The soul can bring its inherent possibilities to scientific development, can manage them practically, can attain the highest levels in its treatment of them, but is quite impotent to alter them. The idea of the Euclidean geometry is actualized in the earliest forms of classical ornament, and that of the infinitesimal calculus in the earliest forms of Gothic architecture, centuries before the first learned mathematicians of the respective cultures were born. A deep inward experience, the genuine awakening of the ego, which turns the child into the higher man and initiates him into the community of his culture, marks the beginning of number sense, as it does that of language sense. It is only after this that objects come to exist for the waking consciousness as things limitable and distinguishable as to number and kind. Only after this that properties, concepts, causal necessity, system in the world around, a form of the world, and world laws, for that which is set and settled is ipso facto bounded, hardened, number governed, are susceptible of exact definition. And therewith comes, too, a sudden, almost metaphysical, feeling of anxiety and awe regarding the deeper meaning of measuring and counting, drawing and form. Now, Kant has classified the sum of human knowledge according to syntheses a priori, necessarily and universally valid, and a posteriori, experiential and variable from case to case, and in the former class has included mathematical knowledge. Thereby, doubtless, he was enabled to reduce a strong inward feeling to abstract form. But quite apart from the fact, amply evidenced in modern mathematics and mechanics, that there is no such sharp distinction between the two as is originally and unconditionally implied in the principle, the a priori itself, though certainly one of the most inspired conceptions of philosophy, is a notion that seems to involve enormous difficulties. With it, Kant postulates, without attempting to prove what is quite incapable of proof, both unalterableness of form in all intellectual activity and identity of form for all men in the same. And in consequence, a factor of incalculable importance is, thanks to the intellectual prepossessions of his period, not to mention his own, simply ignored. This factor is the varying degree of this alleged universal validity. There are doubtless certain characters of very wide-ranging validity which are, seemingly at any rate, independent of the culture and century to which the cognizing individual may belong. But along with these, there is a quite particular necessity of form which underlies all his thought as axiomatic, and to which he is subject by virtue of belonging to his own culture and no other. Here, then, we have two very different kinds of a priori thought content, and the definition of a frontier between them, or even the demonstration that such exists, is a problem that lies beyond all possibilities of knowing and will never be solved. So far, no one has dared to assume that the supposed constant structure of the intellect is an illusion, and that the history spread out before us contains more than one style of knowing. But we must not forget that unanimity about things that have not yet become problems may just as well imply universal error as universal truth. True, there has always been a certain sense of doubt and obscurity, so much so that the correct guess might have been made from that non-agreement of the philosophers which every glance at the history of philosophy shows us. But that this non-agreement is not due to imperfections of the human intellect or present gaps in a perfectible knowledge, in a word, is not due to defect but to destiny and historical necessity, this is a discovery. Conclusions on the deep and final things are to be reached not by predicating constants, but by studying differentiae and developing the organic logic of differences. The comparative morphology of knowledge forms is a domain which Western thought has still to attack. 4. If mathematics were a mere science, like astronomy or mineralogy, it would be possible to define their object. This man is not and never has been able to do. We West Europeans may put our own scientific notion of number to perform the same tasks as those with which the mathematicians of Athens and Baghdad busied themselves. But the fact remains that the theme, the intention, and the methods of the like-named science in Athens and in Baghdad were quite different from those of our own. There is no mathematic, but only mathematics. What we call the history of mathematics, implying merely the progressive actualizing of a single invariable ideal, is in fact, below the deceptive surface of history, a complex of self-contained and independent developments, an ever-repeated process of bringing to birth new form worlds and appropriating, transforming, and sloughing alien form worlds. A purely organic story of blossoming, ripening, wilting, and dying within the set period. The student must not let himself be deceived. The mathematic of the classical soul sprouted almost out of nothingness. The historically constituted Western soul, already possessing the classical science, not inwardly but outwardly as a thing learnt, had to win its own by apparently altering and perfecting, but in reality destroying, the essentially alien Euclidean system. In the first case, the agent was Pythagoras, in the second, Descartes. In both cases, the act is, at bottom, the same. The relationship between the form language of a mathematic and that of the cognate major arts, as also those of law and of money, is in this way put beyond doubt. The temperament of the thinker and that of the artist differ widely indeed, but the expression methods of the waking consciousness are inwardly the same for each. The sense of form of the sculptor, the painter, the composer is essentially mathematical in its nature. The same inspired ordering of an infinite world which manifested itself in the geometrical analysis and projective geometry of the 17th century could vivify, energize, and suffuse contemporary music with the harmony that it developed out of the art of thorough bass, which is the geometry of the sound world, and contemporary painting with the principle of perspective, the felt geometry of the space world that only the West knows. This inspired ordering is that which Goethe called the idea, of which the form is immediately apprehended in the domain of intuition, whereas pure science does not apprehend, but observes and dissects. The mathematic goes beyond observation and dissection, and in its highest moments finds the way by vision, not abstraction. To Goethe again we owe the profound saying, "The mathematician is only complete in so far as he feels within himself the beauty of the true." Here we feel how nearly the secret of number is related to the secret of artistic creation. And so the born mathematician takes his place by the side of the great masters of the fugue, the chisel, and the brush. He and they alike strive and must strive to actualize the grand order of all things by clothing it in symbol, and so to communicate it to the plain fellow man who hears that order within himself, but cannot effectively possess it. The domain of number, like the domains of tone, line, and colour, becomes an image of the world form. For this reason, the word creative means more in the mathematical sphere than it does in the pure sciences. Newton, Gauss, and Riemann were artist natures, and we know with what suddenness their great conceptions came upon them. "A mathematician," said old Weierstrass, "who is not at the same time a bit of a poet, will never be a full mathematician." The mathematic, then, is an art. As such, it has its styles and style periods. It is not, as the layman and the philosopher, who is in this matter a layman too, imagine, substantially unalterable, but subject, like every art, to unnoticed changes from epoch to epoch. The development of the great arts ought never to be treated without an assuredly not unprofitable side glance at contemporary mathematics. In the very deep relation between changes of musical theory and the analysis of the infinite, the details have never yet been investigated, although aesthetics might have learnt a great deal more from these than from all so-called psychology. Still more revealing would be a history of musical instruments written not, as it always is, from the technical standpoint of tone production, but as a study of the deep spiritual bases of the tone colours and tone effects aimed at. For it was the wish, intensified to the point of a longing, to fill a spatial infinity with sound which produced, in contrast to the classical lyre and reed, lyra, kithara, aulos, syrinx, and the Arabian lute, the two great families of keyboard instruments, organ, pianoforte, etc., and bow instruments, and that as early as the Gothic time. The development of both these families belongs spiritually, and possibly also in point of technical origin, to the Celtic Germanic north lying between Ireland, the Weser, and the Seine. The organ and clavichord belong certainly to England. The bow instruments reached their definite forms in Upper Italy between 1480 and 1530, while it was principally in Germany that the organ was developed into the space-commanding giant that we know, an instrument the like of which does not exist in all musical history. The free organ playing of Bach and his time was nothing if it was not analysis. Analysis of a strange and vast tone world. And similarly, it is in conformity with the Western number thinking, and in opposition to the classical, that our string and wind instruments have been developed not singly, but in great groups, strings, woodwind, brass, ordered within themselves according to the compass of the four human voices. The history of the modern orchestra, with all its discoveries of new and modification of old instruments, is in reality the self-contained history of one tone world. A world, moreover, that is quite capable of being expressed in the forms of the higher analysis. 5. When, about 540 BC, the circle of the Pythagoreans arrived at the idea that number is the essence of all things, it was not a step in the development of mathematics that was made, but a wholly new mathematic that was born. Long heralded by metaphysical problem posings and artistic form tendencies, now it came forth from the depths of the classical soul as a formulated theory, a mathematic born in one act at one great historical moment, just as the mathematic of the Egyptians had been, and the algebra astronomy of the Babylonian culture, with its ecliptic coordinate system, and new, for these older mathematics had long been extinguished, and the Egyptian was never written down. Fulfilled by the 2nd century BC, the classical mathematic vanished in its turn, for though it seemingly exists even today, it is only as a convenience of notation that it does so, and gave place to the Arabian. From what we know of the Alexandrian mathematic, it is a necessary presumption that there was a great movement within the Middle East, of which the centre of gravity must have lain in the Persian-Babylonian schools, such as Edessa, Gondosapora, and Ctesiphon, and of which only details found their way into the regions of classical speech. In spite of their Greek names, the Alexandrian mathematicians, Zenodorus, who dealt with figures of equal perimeter, Serenus, who worked on the properties of a harmonic pencil in space, Hypsicles, who introduced the Chaldean circle division, Diophantus, above all, were all without doubt Arameans, and their works only a small part of a literature which was written principally in Syriac. This mathematic found its completion in the investigations of the Arabian Islamic thinkers, and after these, there was again a long interval. And then a perfectly new mathematic was born, the Western, our own, which in our infatuation we regard as mathematics, as the culmination and the implicit purpose of 2,000 years' evolution, though in reality its centuries are strictly numbered, and today almost spent. The most valuable thing in the classical mathematic is its proposition that number is the essence of all things perceptible to the senses. Defining number as a measure, it contains the whole world feeling of a soul passionately devoted to the here and the now. Measurement in this sense means the measurement of something near and corporeal. Consider the content of the classical artwork, say the freestanding statue of a naked man. Here every essential and important element of being, its whole rhythm, is exhaustively rendered by surfaces, dimensions, and the sensuous relations of the parts. The Pythagorean notion of the harmony of numbers, although it was probably deduced from music, a music, be it noted, that knew not polyphony or harmony, and formed its instruments to render single, plump, almost fleshy tones, seems to be the very mould for a sculpture that has this ideal. The worked stone is only a something insofar as it has considered limits and measured form. What it is what it has become under the sculptor's chisel. Apart from this, it is a chaos, something not yet actualized, in fact, for the time being, a null. The same feeling transferred to the grander stage produces, as an opposite to the state of chaos, that of cosmos, which for the classical soul implies a cleared-up situation of the external world, a harmonic order which includes each separate thing as a well-defined, comprehensible, and present entity. The sum of such things constitutes neither more nor less than the whole world, and the interspaces between them, which for us are filled with the impressive symbol of the universe of space, are for them the nonent, tomeon, nothingness, void. Extension means for classical mankind body, and for us space, and it is as a function of space that, to us, things appear. And looking backward from this standpoint, we may perhaps see into the deepest concept of the classical metaphysics, Anaximander's apeiron, literally without end, but a word that is quite untranslatable into any Western tongue. It is that which possesses no number in the Pythagorean sense of the word, no measurable dimensions or definable limits, and therefore no being. The measureless, the negation of form, the statue not yet carved out of the block, the arche, optically boundless and formless, which only becomes a something, namely the world, after being split up by the senses. It is the underlying form a priori of classical cognition, bodilessness as such, which is replaced exactly in the Kantian world picture by that space out of which Kant maintained that all things could be thought forth. We can now understand what it is that divides one mathematic from another, and in particular the classical from the Western. The whole world feeling of the matured classical world led it to see mathematics only as the theory of relations of magnitude, dimension, and form between bodies. When, from out of this feeling, Pythagoras evolved and expressed the decisive formula, number had come, for him, to be an optical symbol, not a measure of form generally, an abstract relation, but a frontier post of the domain of the become, or rather of that part of it which the senses were able to split up and pass under review. By the whole classical world, without exception, numbers are conceived as units of measure, as magnitude, lengths, or surfaces, and for it no other sort of extension is imaginable. The whole classical mathematic is at bottom stereometry, solid geometry. To Euclid, who rounded off its system in the 3rd century, the triangle is of deep necessity the bounding surface of a body, never a system of three intersecting straight lines, or a group of three points in three-dimensional space. He defines a line as length without breadth. In our mouths, such a definition would be pitiful. In the classical mathematic, it was brilliant. The Western number two is not, as Kant and even Helmholtz thought, something proceeding out of time as an a priori form of conception, but is something specifically spatial, in that it is an order or ordering of like units. Actual time, as we shall see more and more clearly in the sequel, has not the slightest relation with mathematical things. Numbers belong exclusively to the domain of extension. But there are precisely as many possibilities, and therefore necessities, of ordered presentation of the extended as there are cultures. Classical number is a thought process dealing not with spatial relations, but with visibly limitable and tangible units. And it follows naturally and necessarily that the classical knows only the natural, positive and whole numbers, which on the contrary play in our Western mathematics a quite undistinguished part in the midst of complex, hypercomplex, non-Archimedean and other number systems. On this account, the idea of irrational numbers, the unending decimal fractions of our notation, was unrealizable within the Greek spirit. Euclid says, and he ought to have been better understood, that incommensurable lines are not related to one another like numbers. In fact, it is the idea of irrational number that, once achieved, separates the notion of number from that of magnitude. For the magnitude of such a number, pi, for example, can never be defined or exactly represented by any straight line. Moreover, it follows from this that in considering the relation, say, between diagonal and side in a square, the Greek would be brought up suddenly against a quite other sort of number, which was fundamentally alien to the classical soul, and was consequently feared as a secret of its proper existence, too dangerous to be unveiled. There is a singular and significant late Greek legend according to which the man who first published The Hidden Mystery of the Irrational perished by shipwreck, for the unspeakable and the formless must be left hidden forever. The fear that underlies this legend is the selfsame notion that prevented even the ripest Greeks from extending their tiny city-states so as to organize the countryside politically, from laying out their streets to end in prospects and their alleys to give vistas, that made them recoil time and again from the Babylonian astronomy with its penetration of endless starry space, and refused to venture out of the Mediterranean along sea paths long before dared by the Phoenicians and the Egyptians. It is the deep metaphysical fear that the sense comprehensible and present in which the classical existence had entrenched itself would collapse and precipitate its cosmos, largely created and sustained by art, into unknown primitive abysses. And to understand this fear is to understand the final significance of classical number, that is, measure in contrast to the immeasurable, and to grasp the high ethical significance of its limitation. Goethe, too, as a nature student, felt it, hence his almost terrified aversion to mathematics, which, as we can now see, was really an involuntary reaction against the non-classical mathematic, the infinitesimal calculus which underlay the natural philosophy of his time. Religious feeling in classical man focused itself ever more and more intensely upon physically present, localized cults, which alone expressed a college of Euclidean deities. Abstractions, dogmas floating homeless in the space of thought were ever alien to it. A cult of this kind has as much in common with a Roman Catholic dogma as the statue has with the cathedral organ. There is no doubt that something of cult was comprised in the Euclidean mathematic. Consider, for instance, The secret doctrines of the Pythagoreans and the theorems of regular polyhedrons with their esoteric significance in the circle of Plato. Just so, there is a deep relation between Descartes' analysis of the infinite and contemporary dogmatic theology as it progressed from the final decisions of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation to entirely desensualized deism. Descartes and Pascal were mathematicians and Jansenists, Leibniz a mathematician and pietist. Voltaire, Lagrange and D'Alembert were contemporaries. Now the classical soul felt the principle of the irrational, which overturned the statuesquely ordered array of whole numbers and the complete and self-sufficing world order for which these stood, as an impiety against the divine itself. In Plato's Timaeus, this feeling is unmistakable, for the transformation of a series of discrete numbers into a continuum challenged not merely the classical notion of number, but the classical world idea itself. And so it is understandable that even negative numbers, which to us offer no conceptual difficulty, were impossible in the classical mathematic, let alone zero as a number, that refined creation of a wonderful abstractive power which, for the Indian soul that conceived it as base for a positional numeration, was nothing more nor less than the key to the meaning of existence. Negative magnitudes have no existence. The expression ((-2) times (-3) equals +6 is neither something perceivable nor a representation of magnitude. The series of magnitudes ends with +1, and in graphic representation of negative numbers, (+3), (+2), (+1), (0), (-1), (-2), (-3), we have suddenly, from 0 onwards, positive symbols of something negative. They mean something, but they no longer are. But the fulfillment of this act did not lie within the direction of classical number thinking. Every product of the waking consciousness of the classical world, then, is elevated to the rank of actuality by way of sculptural definition. That which cannot be drawn is not number. Archytas and Eudoxus use the terms surface and volume numbers to mean what we call second and third powers, and it is easy to understand that the notion of higher integral powers did not exist for them, for a fourth power would predicate at once, for the mind based on the plastic feeling, an extension in four dimensions, and four material dimensions into the bargain, which is absurd. Expressions like 5^9, which we constantly use, or even the fractional index, for example 5^1, which is employed in the Western mathematics as early as Oresme, 14th century, would have been to them utter nonsense. Euclid calls the factors of a product its sides, and fractions, finite of course, were treated as whole number relationships between two lines. Clearly, out of this, no conception of zero as a number could possibly come, for from the point of view of a draftsman it is meaningless. We, having minds differently constituted, must not argue from our habits to theirs and treat their mathematic as a first stage in the development of mathematics. Within and for the purposes of the world that classical man evolved for himself, the classical mathematic was a complete thing. It is merely not so for us. Babylonian and Indian mathematics had long contained, as essential elements of their number worlds, things which the classical number feeling regarded as nonsense. And not from ignorance either, since many a Greek thinker was acquainted with them. It must be repeated, mathematics is an illusion. A mathematical, and generally a scientific way of thinking is right, convincing, a necessity of thought, when it completely expresses the life-feeling proper to it. Otherwise it is either impossible, futile and senseless, or else, as we in the arrogance of our historical soul like to say, primitive. The modern mathematic, though true only for the Western spirit, is undeniably a masterwork of that spirit. And yet to Plato it would have seemed a ridiculous and painful aberration from the path leading to the true, to wit, the classical, mathematic. And so with ourselves. Plainly, we have almost no notion of the multitude of great ideas belonging to other cultures that we have suffered to lapse because our thought, with its limitations, has not permitted us to assimilate them, or, which comes to the same thing, has led us to reject them as false, superfluous, and nonsensical.